The New York Times describes Charles Burnett as, quote, the nation's least known great filmmaker and most gifted black director. On Tuesday, he speaks with fellow filmmakers Julie Dash and Bradford Young at Bard College as a part of the school's Creative Process and Dialogue, Art and the Public Today series. Burnett, director of films like Killer of Sheep and The Glass Shield, was deeply involved in the UCLA Film School's LA Rebellion film movement, an explosion of African-American films from the 1960s to the 1980s, addressing social issues. He spoke with WAMC about what role he feels film plays in contemporary American life.
It certainly was different than when I was in film, that's for sure. I mean, when I was in film, starting in film, I was impacted by the civil rights movement and all these other progressive things that were going on at the time. And film then was, there was a definite purpose in my mind for film. It was a means of social change. I don't know if that's the case with young people today. I think it's more or less getting a job, which I understand more so because of the fact that it costs so much to go to school and you have these student loans that you better find something that'll pay them back, you know, so you better be commercial enough, you know, to get to the public and so you can survive. So I think we had purpose for making films, it seems. And I mean, most of us like Julie Dash and myself and Haile Gerima and some other folks at the time, you know, if film was a way of discussing, you know, what was current and what was important in our lives. We didn't have homelessness like we do now. I mean, I would suspect that students would be more interested in trying to use film to solve a lot of these problems or talk about them, you know, because it's just getting worse and worse. And maybe we just had that commitment. There were all these talks about what we were supposed to be doing and the use of film. And I think it's a different attitude now. And I think the other thing is that a lot of us who went to UCLA at the time or in film at the time, we sort of understood what a narrative was about and what storytelling was about and things like that. And so a lot of us had ideas and scripts already prepared and wanted to make feature films that deal not so much commercially or entertain people, but again, to express who we are as people, and particularly arguing or fighting against the sort of stereotypical images that Hollywood had created and perpetuated.
You're talking about your days at UCLA back in the 1970s and the black independent movement in film. Take me back to that moment in time. What problems were you seeing in the world of cinema that you wanted to fix or address with the black independent movement?
It's telling our stories. For example, it all started, and one of the starting points was the distribution of A Birth of a Nation, which really distorted a period in American history, which was probably one of the most progressive periods, Reconstruction, and it sort of demonized who we were as people. I'm sure most of you probably seen Birth of a Nation, how it represented black people. And then Hollywood sort of continued over the years, at least up until I was in film, wanting to get in film, doing the same thing, telling our stories in a negative way. And we wanted to react against that. We formed organizations to talk about what we should be doing as a black filmmaker and telling stories that represented who we were and who we are, you know, and so that was our goal, you know, to counter the sort of stereotypes that Hollywood, you know, it never wanted to present us as human beings, you know, people with a heart and soul, people who had families and empathized with other folks, you know. We were just one-dimensional. And, you know, growing up and being a child of that period, you know, everyone wants to have some sort of image of who they are. It helps build self-esteem and things like that. And all we were asking for was just to be ordinary, just to be who we are. And we had to fight to get that, you know, and that's why a lot of us, like Julie Dash, Haile Gerima, and Ben Caldwell, Sharon Larkin, and Kathy Collins, and a whole bunch of other people, took up film as a means to show proper representation.
Over the course of your life, how have you seen the condition of African-American life in this country change?
It's scary. I think in many ways that part of it has been very good. I'm sort of hesitant because, you know, this whole thing was, you look at all the things that happened in the 60s and all the progress we made that was, now it seems like it's reversing. It seems as though we need more conscious awareness of the fact that we're like in danger of voting rights and everything. You know, we're being handicapped, we're being disenfranchised, you know, and it's something that in terms of democracy, that the country should have stopped and said, no, this is wrong. You don't disenfranchise voters. You make it possible for them to vote. And I'll tell you something very interesting. I was talking to a friend of mine about, you know, I'm a member of the DGA and the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Science. And the thing about this is that they make you vote. They encourage you to vote for the awards. They call you up and say, you know, we have 4 days left, whatever it is, 5 days left to vote. Please vote. And they keep calling you. And then they look at, you know, when you vote, do you log in? And they can see that you voted. So they'll keep calling you until you've actually voted. You know, that's how much they're concerned about your rights as a member, making sure you observe those rights and participate in this voting thing. They need to do something like that in terms of the national politics and national voting for president or local politics, whatever it is. Make sure that you do vote. Even if they call you or send someone out there, make it possible. They don't do that now. You have to go back and continue to fight for the stuff that we gained in the marches and stuff that we did in the 60s to guarantee, and it's an ongoing thing. You know, I mean, school education used to be free when I was coming up, and that's why I stayed at UCLA for so long, because you could go there for like $15 at UCLA, a quarter. Now it's so expensive. Junior college was free. You don't have that now, and so, I mean, I'm off maybe on the wrong thing, but generally speaking, you really have to look at where we are now. When I was coming up, they didn't have homelessness like it is now. You didn't have families in the streets. And so you make that very clear that something has definitely changed for the worse. So, I mean, it can change back. So I think we have to sort of like look at methods and means of how do we do that, how we get this place back on its foot again.
When you look today at filmmakers like Ava DuVernay, Jordan mm-hmm. Peele, Ryan Coogler, Boots Riley, there's this whole new generation of black filmmakers. What do you see in this new generation, you know, especially in comparison to your own efforts to break into the industry with your colleagues all those decades ago?
Well, I think all those are wonderful people. I know Ava, and she's been wonderful. I mean, she's helped a lot of people have an organization. She isn't someone who's just thinking about herself and forgetting about the community and other filmmakers. She's been really helpful in helping women particularly find a place in this industry, you know, and to be able to tell their stories. So I take my hats off to them and all the other folks, you know, because they've shown that black independent films, black films can make money, can, you know, break the box office, you know, like Black Panther made $1.5 billion, you know, over a period of time. So, I mean, a short period of time. And, you know, it's proven that people will go see films by people of color. So and it's also encouraged young people who wanted to get into film that there is a place for you. I mean, I know when Spike came on the scene, you'd be surprised how many people got into film because of Spike, you know, the notoriety of Spike. They were really, like, waiting for someone to say, hey, this is possible. You know, when I was in film, taking film, it was kind of problematic to say to people, I'm studying film, because they were like, what black filmmaker are encouraging to do this? Because it wasn't, I mean, there were people like Oscar Michaud earlier, there was Spencer Williams and all these folks, and, you know, and then later on, Sidney Poitier, who made films, and Gordon Parks particularly, Melvin Van Peebles. It was a small group of people who were out there that we could identify with and be encouraged by. But now it's like there's so many people and so many people of color in the industry now and making films. So that's really a positive step in terms of Hollywood. But still, I mean, they're far from being independent films. I mean, it's subject matter and content. They're entertaining films, which is good. But to be an independent film that talks about the political situation, about what's going on, is still, I think, lacking in a certain way. And not that people are going to go see political films necessarily, but it's good to have a variety, not just films that people could sort of escape continuously. Because look at the problems we have in this country, homelessness. You know, we need films that will address that, you know, and can encourage us to do something about it.
Your upbringing in the neighborhood Watts in Los Angeles had a huge impact on your filmmaking. What was it like to translate your experience on the street there into films like Killer of Sheep?
It was very easy because one of the things, you know, there's all these stories there. There's, in the Hispanic and Asian community that need to be addressed. And so there was like these narratives that were burning inside you that needed to be told. And so we were very encouraged by the fact that we needed to do it. And the Watts was really misunderstood. You know, there wasn't, you know, when the Watts riot, I remember, happened, and the press said, the Times and Herald Examiner said that something like, you know, we knew more about what's happening in Europe than we did in Watts, you know, which was interesting and true, you know. So we needed to have a group of people, filmmakers, artists, writers, poets, and novelists, to talk about our community and tell stories about it, you know, because in order to grow as a person, you do need some dialogue between people who can sort of encourage you to present a narrative that will lend itself to your development. I mean, Watts was very, I mean, there was a lot of stories. I mean, I grew up, I wasn't in Watts per se, but I was like 3 blocks away from Watts proper where I grew up. And but I went to school there, and so I knew that there were really lovely, decent people that I grew up and admired, you know. And my whole objective was to bring these people to the screen in the life and sort of share it with, you know, the wider public, you know, who we are. Because it was just like really an awful segregation in Los Angeles at the time, you know. There was Inglewood. There were all these communities that you couldn't go into at night, you know. It was, you know, it was like sundowner towns. We need to address those things because young people and people are going to suffer from these attitudes, discrimination, and so forth. And so we needed something to help to alleviate, you know, these crazy ideas and stuff and racism and things that's sort of historically been there to sort of prevent you from getting a good education and jobs and things like that, you know. So, well, no, we had a lot of objectives when we were making films. You know, it wasn't about making money and becoming famous or anything like that. I mean, there was some aspect, I suppose. You always want to do something that you're going to get paid for. But, no, when I was making films, a lot of us, we thought we, because Hollywood didn't exist for us, you know. You didn't have some relative in the business or a thing like that. You weren't going to find a job there because it was just closed. So I just thought I'd be making films as a hobby and showing whatever I did do and however I did it to the community, you know, on a small level, and have these discussions, you know, and would have a job, a regular job, supporting myself and family, and this would just be a hobby in a sense. But it changed because of a whole bunch of factors that made it possible for me to make films and make a living off of it.
Who were some of your filmmaking heroes back in your early days?
I think the ones who were really visible in many ways. I mean, when Gordon Parks did Shaft and The Learning Tree, that was really special. And I think Melvin Van Peebles, who did Sweetback, sort of like was sort of a revolutionary kind of a moment in a sense because it was sort of opened the door to a whole new sort of like idea of what film can be and do. I mean, Third World Cinema also played a big part in helping develop who we are as a filmmaker and what we should be doing. And, you know, and there's a teacher by the name of LSL Taylor who taught at UCLA, one of the early black professors there, who brought political films to the campus. And we had showings and things like that and invited a lot of these political filmmakers to campus and had these discussions. And it really was inspiring and insightful because from those films we had a clear idea what we should be doing, what kind of films we should be making.
A lot of your work deals with deeply subjective emotional experiences during historical events. I'm interested, can you talk a little bit about that dynamic between telling a very personal story and also fulfilling that mission you described of like addressing social issues and concerns?
You lived in a situation like, say, for example, like in and around Watts, South Central, where, in a sense, everything was, in a sense, political. At least we looked at it. We looked at how police treatment of people of color, you know, about jobs. We knew that there were all these things that had a lot to do with society and historically were things that we were still dealing with. And so we wanted to make films that would address these things, you know. And I think one of the most interesting thing about growing up in that time was because of the Civil Rights Movement and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and people like that, we had the notion that we were responsible to making a difference, to talking about these social issues that we lived under and was affected by, you know. So the obvious thing was if you had a means of telling those stories, you tell them in what was popular. And cinema suddenly Well, not suddenly. It's always been really popular, you know. But then we found a more personal use for it. You know, we thought that, again, that it was important for us to affect change, and that was our goal. That was our responsibility.
Talking about the movie The Glass Shield, you know, telling a story about the Los Angeles Police Department in the 90s, well, that was a very fraught era with a lot of tension and a lot of violence. What experience was it like to make that movie? Did you ever feel any sense of danger to address that topic at such a heightened time?
No. I thought it was certainly something that was needed, and it gave us an opportunity to take advantage of it. I was sort of wondering what would the police feel about a story that was based on a true incident, a very controversial incident where a young man was killed by the police in mysterious circumstances, you know. And then the person with the story was based on was John A.D. Johnson, that he was one of the first black police persons to integrate the department in this particular community. And he wrote this story that was about himself and what had happened in this particular precinct. And anyway, the story got to me through Chet Walker, who was a former basketball player who turned producer. And he had this story, and he came to me and said, would you like to make this movie? And I read it, and it was a very simple story at the beginning, because it was simply about this particular young man's life. And at the time, there was all these things that were happening in the community around the country about police brutality and how people were abused and how they were sentenced unfairly over years. And almost, there's one particular case where the person almost got executed because this corrupt prosecutor had lied about the evidence and didn't care, didn't have any feelings at all. 60 Minutes had did an expose of what happened then and where it was now, and how this guy had spent over 17 years on death row. And the prosecution and knew that he didn't do it. And then when they reopened the case and looked at it, and they found that it was just one of the worst misjustice, however you say it, justice that perpetrated on an individual, innocent person, you know. And they didn't care if he was executed or not, as long as he won the case. And so I did all this research and study about all these police things that they did that was really unfair, and I sort of made the story wider and brought in all these other incidences that helped to tell the story about police corruption and unfairness, and how this young kid who wanted to be a policeman all his life to do good, and he ends up being corrupted by the very institution that he's thinking that would be a savior, you know, in a sense that it would benefit the community and they do good, and he discovers that it was corrupt, and he inadvertently think that he was doing good by lying to convict this person that he thought he was, that this person was guilty, really guilty, and he thought that a small lie to get this person off the street would be justified in a sense because of the fact that he got rid of this criminal off the street, and he finds out that that lie was really the thing that he should have told the truth, and he discovered that he was compromised by his own police department by supporting another police officer who was totally corrupt, because this whole thing about being a part of an institution where it's so important to be welcome, to be a part of this institution, because your whole life depends on it, and that he had forgotten who he was, and the fact that that's how you get corrupted, by doing something very small, thinking it's innocent, when the basic is the thing he should have did. We just told the truth, and this tragedy wouldn't have happened. Anyway, so it was all about how you could be corrupted by doing the right thing. It was part of the theme that I wanted to tell in the story about the glass shield, you know. And so that's how that came about. And that's why I was sort of encouraged about doing it, because it allowed me to talk about all the contradictions and things like that in society, and being a character who wants to do well but finds himself doing wrong by just the opposite, by wanting to get a criminal off, a person who he thought was a criminal. And it turns out he was the one who was wrong.